Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the U.S. Social Security Administration. Also joining us from IBM is Nicole Gartner. So, Michael, today SSA faces many challenges regarding the technology and infrastructure they have. I'd like to get a sense of what you're doing to address some of these challenges, i.e. data consolidation using the cloud.
So I think 5 years ago, we had a huge IT infrastructure problem. And again, because we weren't communicating with each other, we didn't even realize how bad it was. So we had a national computer center that was designed in the late 70s, built in the early 80s with a 20-year life expectancy that was getting close to 30 years old. And we're running out of capacity to put more servers in. And more ominously, the utilities were built in such a way, for instance, that the pipes for the cooling that we need, and we use an enormous amount of water, and we use an enormous amount of electricity, were built parallel. So after, you know, we have pipes built with a 20-year expectancy. So what happens is they start to corrode, they leak, and then they short into the system. So that's a real risk for us in addition to the facility just not having been built for today's technology and not having the capacity we need going forward. So we needed to move on replacement on that. We also, the agency had started building its first backup facility. And to think that an engine that pumps almost $70 billion a month into the national economy had no backup capacity is shocking. The backup plan in an emergency was to run to a commercial facility in New Jersey. You know, two field office managers would get the call, said run to the facility, reserve as much time as you could buy. The maximum that they could buy would be back up about 10% of our capacity, and the transition time to get up and running in New Jersey would have been very long. So the good news is that we've made substantial progress toward fixing both programs. We have a second facility now in the South that backs up 100% of our capacity. I was able to change the design of that really at the last minute, make some additional investment. So instead of backing up 50% of our capacity, it backs up 100%, and that's great. And we can now flip from one to the other in about 5.5 hours and then another 5.5 hours to test and make sure that we've done it right. And that's a huge improvement. Congress also in the Recovery Act approved the money that we need to build a new primary facility. And so that site has been purchased. Site preparation is ongoing, and we're planning on having the groundbreaking in April. So that's a longer-term project, but that will allow us to meet our base needs. We've been a little careful about the cloud for security reasons, and it's also just capacity reasons. Are we running one of the largest computer systems in the world? We have days where the way that the systems people measure transactions, where we have 800 million transactions. It's a huge facility.
So there was a study done by the Partnership for Public Service and the Center for the Business of Government called From Data to Decisions, The Power of Analytics. How is SSA demonstrating measurable improvements by using analytics? How are you using analytics? And what are some of the data-driven decision-making that you've been using over the last few years?
Sure. So let me give you a couple examples of new and interesting things that we're doing. So we have a tremendous new tool that was developed pretty much skunk work style, which I'm proud of by some people, called policy feedback. And so we are now able with this tool to snake very efficiently through our own records to find out exactly sort of what's happening. So 5 years ago, you came and said, well, you know, do we have an issue with the accuracy of our determinations in colon cancer? Because it looks like it's very different in some parts of the country than the other. Well, there was no very efficient way to do that except to ask the Inspector General or the Office of Quality to do a pretty labor-intensive study. We can now sit in front of a computer and very quickly push a button, find where the outliers are, and then go in case by case in the outliers. So if so in the example, the demonstration I saw where there were some outlier statistics for head and neck cancer, we were able in probably about half an hour to go in and look at the individual case files in three or four of the states that were outliers, and it was pretty clear to someone who was not a trained examiner, such as me, that there was confusion between esophageal cancer and head and neck cancer. And so we could say, okay, we need to go, we need to clarify for those states how they're supposed to be handling things. So that kind of thing we're doing more and more of, and it's very exciting. Another thing that, you know, we did, we had had a time-honored algorithm for allocating staff in field offices that a number of our people were very attached to, and they felt, you know, was almost unchallengeable. But, you know, you went out into the field and you looked at what happened, and you saw that there were certain disparities and that things weren't adding up, and that there were some offices with almost no waiting room traffic and some that were backed up, you know, terribly. And I started to see, I thought some patterns there. So really made people go back over about a 12-month period and bang away on to challenge the algorithm, to see where the waiting room traffic was and to see why we saw these disparities. And sure enough, at the end of the project, we could see that the algorithm had not changed and adapted to changes in the SSI program from 1974. And the SSI work is very labor-intensive, and it gets more labor-intensive every year because Congress has not put an inflation adjustment on the asset and resource limitations. So every single year, it is more labor-intensive to do SSI cases than the year before, but our algorithm hadn't changed in 20-plus years. And so I try to be a catalyst for asking those types of questions and using the enormous wealth of information that we have to try to address problems that we can see or suspect in our systems.
So still on the theme of citizen services, what has SA been doing to transform the customer service function? And to what extent are you expanding the availability of online and web capabilities?
So with all due respect to all the other federal agencies, we're clearly the leader when it comes to electronic services. And I mentioned the Michigan studies that confirm that. And so we are embracing this very enthusiastically. We embrace usability. We not only have an office that specializes in it, we have outside contractors look at it. And for anyone that's significant, I make them run it through for me personally, and I pick away at it too before it goes up and online. And I think that's made a big difference for us. We're trying to do things that people thought were not possible before. So, for instance, one of our most popular services is any American can go online at socialsecurity.gov and get a personalized estimate of their retirement benefit. And it not only, you know, with the old paper statement that went out, we just gave you one number that was based on one retirement age. And that's helpful, but in some ways, it's also a little counterproductive because part of the goal of the exercise is to get people thinking about their alternatives, not just thinking about one date. So what we've also tried to do is move away from sort of guiding people towards early retirement, which is effectively what we were doing, in my opinion, to being less directive but giving a lot more information and giving people, for the first time, the opportunity to run retirement scenarios. So if you're trying to figure out your planning, you can sit in front of your own computer and you can say, how much would I get if I retire at 62? How much at 65? How much at 70? And while that's important for people like me, it's more important for people like you, because statistically, you're probably going to live 6 years longer than me. And so when we look at the growing number of the older aging population, people in their 80s, 90s, and increasing number of centenarians, they're heavily female. And so if a woman makes a bad choice at the retirement, it's probably something that she's going to have to live with a lot longer than if I make a bad choice. So we're trying to get people thinking about those things, but not necessarily telling them what to do. Another thing that we do in that regard with the estimator, and this was actually, we got some great input from actually from our British colleagues on this, is people have a tendency to underestimate their life expectancy by about 5 years, which also could make you make a bad choice. So we now have a rudimentary lifetime estimator as well, right there with the retirement estimator. So you can not only think about how much money you would get at certain ages, you can plug in personal information and see statistically how long you might be able to live. At least it plants the thought that maybe you ought to be planning for living a little longer than you might think that you would live.
So we talked a little bit about the fiscal constraints that exist today. And it, obviously, in a situation where there are all these difficulties, the style of the leader is very important. You mentioned your distinct style before. Reflecting a little bit on your leadership of SSA, can you tell us how you keep your employees focused and motivated in the face of some of these really pretty tough challenges and changes that you have to make?
Well, I think the most important thing is treating them with respect. I mean, I think that, you know, this is a group of people who are extremely talented. They could have done other things with their lives. In general, they've come to the agency because they're very attached to the mission. And so, to a large extent, you know, they run on that. And I think the most important thing in a lot of ways is kind of not getting in the way, you know, not tying them down with bureaucracy, not saying things that damage morale, and making them feel that they are making an impact by telling them what the agency is doing overall. So those, I think, are the most important things that we try to do.
What are you doing to make sure you have a highly trained and competent workforce?
So we have tried to do several things. One is we've expanded our outreach a little bit. I think that we had sometimes in some parts of the country been too narrow in our hiring. And because money came unpredictably and you often have to hire quickly, I think it's a little harder, for instance, to recruit disabled employees under those sort of circumstances. So we've had special programs to make sure that when we can hire, that we have pools that reflect our expectations in terms of a diverse workforce. And so I'm quite proud of the fact that when the Recovery Act money came, we hired about 20% of the agency in a year and a half, and we did extremely well on any objective metric of diversity, including disabled hiring, where we're basically the best in the federal government except for the EEOC. I think planning and being prepared on the hiring, we've also recognized that our main source of hiring is coming up from the grassroots, from the field. And I think that's good. And I think that will always be that way. But we've also said, you know, there are certain areas where we probably need to be a little bit more aggressive about getting in some people with a different kind of background and a different kind of perspective, particularly in the systems and IT areas. So we've started a program called the Hardy Apfel Fellowship Program, where we only hire from the top 15 IT graduate programs. And, you know, we actually had some skepticism internally, given that, you know, with civil service restrictions, we can't offer very much money and very much in the way of anything that would look as a perk. I mean, we actually present FaceTime with me as one of the perks. So, you know, go figure that might work. But, you know, the first year, we got a very talented group, but we weren't turning away top-notch people. The program's really caught on because we're taking in about 9, and we got 32 applicants. We turned down remarkable people from Caltech and MIT and stuff because the class is so strong. So I think what those people will do, where typically our systems people started in the field and learned systems later in their career or more recently came in from a contractor, these are going to be, I think, the people that are going to be our big think IT strategic planners of the future. And so far, it seems to be going well. We've only lost one since we started the program, and they're great individuals. And they challenge our people a little bit. You know, they're confident, as they should be, because they're very good. And they look at our world a little differently than we have. And that's a healthy tension for us. And I think that a significant number of these young people are going to be, you know, the top leaders of the agency 10, 20 years down the road.
But what does the future hold for the U.S. Social Security Administration? We will ask its commissioner, Michael Astrew, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.